Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. With Mobile's award-winning garden expert and chief horticultural advisor for Mobile Botanical Gardens, Bill Finch. We'll talk about living and growing on the Gulf Coast. Now, your personal yard and garden consultant, here's Bill Finch.
Welcome back. It started out chilly. It's going to get warm. That's okay. Not too warm. It's about the right time, right temperatures for this time of year. I do think we may make up for our chilling deficit at least a little farther north. I wouldn't expect big things if you've got peaches and pears and apples that are not adapted to the particular climate of where you live. If you want to know what that means, you give me a call. But I think we're going to do all right for chill hours this year, and people who have the right adapted fruit trees are going to see things okay. Generally not going to warm up until late in the week. This is fine. We're going to have temperatures below 40 degrees. This is really important for keeping things sort of tucked in. So it could end up after with a good spring after all. Really nice to see all across the state. If you've got any questions about what you should be doing now and what you should be planning out, of course, you feel free to call me. Let's talk about it. Let's talk about your seedlings, too. This is a good time. I mean, a lot of people are making the transition. Some are just starting farther north, those on the coast. Well, you've got some seeds that should be well out of the ground now. Let's talk about what to do with them. You feel free to give me a call. You know, here's the thing I want to talk about today. I have a very good reason for wanting to talk to you about it. And that very good reason is I'm working on it. I'm thinking about it. I've been working on it all week. And the thing I'm talking about is barns. Our barns. We don't talk about barns very much, do we? Well, I'll tell you, barns have become tractor sheds, tool sheds, truck sheds, equipment sheds for backhoes and other things, and that's all fine. Every now and then you come across an old barn and you remember, boy, this life used to be a little bit different now, isn't it? Barns used to be a little bit different. There are many things we're losing in Alabama. We like to talk about heritage as if we have one and preserve it. But we don't do a very good job of preserving our heritage. And you know, I guess we don't really want to live like our great-grandparents did. We want to live like, you know, folks in other parts of the country live now. We want to live like folks in California. But barns are out there. There's some really cool barns. And I've been thinking about them because so much of my life has sort of revolved around barns. And I think about the images. You know, my dad and I, we used to build barns. You remember in the day when if somebody said you were going to build a barn, you didn't go down to the metal shop and you didn't go get a bunch of big equipment and drive some big metal posts in the ground or lay a concrete pad or any of those kinds of things. Dad said, well, we got to build a barn. And so Brown Renfro next door, he came over with his tractor. He had an old tractor. Dad had a Model A, which is an incredible, incredibly weird contraption. If you've never seen a Model A John Deere, big flywheel on the side. Chugga, 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 chugga. Brown had a little more modern tractor. It wasn't what you'd consider modern now, but the two of them together, and they, you know what they did? They went down in the woods, they cut some cedar. They didn't go into town. They went and cut some cedar. Brought the cedar up, dug the holes. They didn't use one of them big spinner things that you put on the back of a tractor that digs a hole. They used what we used to call post hole diggers. Right? Did it by hand. Sank those posts in the ground. It's just fine. Not that hard. And then you'd go down to the sawmill, which is never too far away, some Peckerwood sawmill. And you'd get the woods, and you'd lay it up once you, as siding, once you got those posts in the ground and got them connected and wrapped. It was an amazing kind of thing. It was basically trees out of the woods and some nails and a hammer. That's how you built a barn. I got a barn the other day up the country. I've been working on it. It is a fabulous barn. I just got to talk about it because I see it in my head all the time. I see it even when I'm not there. I see it even when I'm not. And I just sitting in that loft of that barn, it's got a big, nice loft. You don't know what lofts are for anymore, do you? Let me tell you what. Let me tell you why barns are built like they are. They used to do this thing. And it's odd. You probably hadn't heard of it before. But they used to do this thing that was called storing hay. You ever heard of that? Yeah, they used to do it. Used to do it in barns. They didn't shrink wrap it like they do now. That's what they do with hay. They shrink wrap it. You ever seen that? That's crazy. But they used to put it in barns. Sometimes they'd put it loose. Sometimes they'd put it in, a little later, they put it in square bales. Now we got the big circular bales, but they would put it in barns. It has a big, beautiful loft, perfect for storing hay. And, you know, I got a use for it. You'll have to ask me someday what I'm going to use that loft for. I'm going to use it for, here's the amazing thing, you won't believe what I'm going to use that loft for. I'm going to use it for hay. Believe it or not, probably square baled, if you care to know. Got a beautiful loft, so you just sit up in that loft and you look out up the hill, out of that barn door, up the hill, and you think, what am I going to do to get the grasses right on that pasture? It's just a great place to view. Downstairs, it's got these beautiful stalls. I don't know what I'm going to put in them. Probably a horse, maybe a horse or two. We'll think about it. We should talk about what you put on a pasture nowadays, and I'll talk about that eventually. It's a good story, but it's a barn. It's an incredible barn, and you know the fun part is, the barn is probably 100-something years old. I don't know exactly. We can't ever figure it out. We know the barn was moved at one point. It's hard to believe you could move a barn this big, but they did. They did it in a day. They moved it from up the hill down the hill because somebody's mama didn't like the smell of the cows that close to the house. You know how that goes. So they moved it down the hill. But the parts of it are very old. Probably was moved to its current location 70 years ago. And it was made from a barn that was built up the hill that was probably 100 years old at the time. Incredibly old barn. Wonderful old barn. But it needs repair. So you know what? I could have gone into town. I could have gone to the store. Got me some metal post or 4x4 post or pour me some concrete, but you know what I did? I got the tractor. It's an old tractor. It doesn't quite chugga 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 like the old Model A, but it's almost sounds like it. Went up in the woods, trimmed up some cedar, which people have just been laying down because nobody knows what to do with cedar anymore. They don't have much use for it. It's already laid down, sitting there in the woods, trimmed the branches off of it, cut it to length, tied a chain on the back of the tractor and towed it back to the barn. Did that 3 or 4 times, had enough posts, dug me a deep post hole about 3 feet deep, dropped those posts in the ground. I'm working on the barn. I'm making the barn again. What a nice thing to have a barn. We should talk more about barns. If you've got a barn, you call me about it. Let's talk about it. Let's talk about what to do with that barn. There ought to be something to do with a good old barn, even though we don't actually use pastures like we used to. Even though, in a way, we don't need those old barns the way we do our agriculture these days. But I think barns can be a fine thing. Kind of a process of discovery. I'm thinking about barns this week. Maybe thinking about what barns are used for. Let's talk about barns. Let's talk about your garden. Give us a call, 251-343-0106.
It's often remembered so many times that my memories are warm. And Daddy, won't you take me back to Muhlenberg County, down by the Green River, where paradise.
Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
Hello, welcome back. Gulf Coast Sunday morning with Plain Gardening. Jim. So Jim and Georgetown sends me a message saying, did you look on Google and see the sorry shape of my barn? No, I didn't, Jim, but now that you've mentioned that. Well, yeah, so forgive me for talking about barns. I think they're an interesting subject. There's a lot of neat barns out there. It's kind of interesting to look at the shape of barns and think, why are barns shaped like they are? Why were they built like they were? And it tells you a little bit about how different things were in the past. It does tell me a lot about, and if you look at barns in the South in particular, you know they're built for airflow. Up north, they're built for winter. Down south, they're built to encourage airflow. And, you know, I don't know how well they did it in various ways, but a lot of times you'll see boards missing in odd places, or you'll see lattice, or you'll see other things. It's interesting to think about those old barns. Some of them have something called a widow's peak. If you don't know what a widow's peak is on a barn, it's probably other names, kind of an overhang from the roof that sticks out a lot farther than the rest of the roof. You want to know what that's for? You give me a call. We'll talk about it sometime. It's really cool. It's really cool. Barns are a fun thing to think about. Now, I know that a lot of folks think, well, it's an old barn. The only thing I can do is turn it into a house. And I'll tell you, I think barns make terrible houses. That's just my view of things. Well, they do, in fact, make terrible houses for a lot of reasons. You'd have to really change them from being a barn into something quite other than a barn. You might as well take it down and start over. My old barn, you couldn't do that, I don't think, because it's got those old cedar posts. I'll tell you one thing about those old cedar posts. You'd think they're planted in the ground. They aren't treated. They don't have any chemical treatment on them. They're probably, some of those posts are easily 120 years old. They're still there. Says something about cedar. Cedar will last a good long while if it's thick enough. Doesn't last as long in South Alabama as it does in North Alabama. I agree, but it lasts a long time. While I was cutting that cedar, I should talk about this. It's so much fun. While I was cutting that cedar, I cut into another limb next to it to get it out of the way. And it was just the most unbelievable color of yellow. I mean, it was just yellow. And I said, well, I'll be dadgum. Bodock. Anybody know what Bodock is? If you were building a farm, you knew what Bodock was if you were from South Mississippi and South Alabama. Osage orange, mock orange some folks call it, but we call it Bodock. Bodark, whichever you prefer. The old French word, the wood of the bow. Incredible wood, lasts forever. And I'm thinking, goodness gracious, all those twisty limbs, which nobody would know what to do with nowadays, except they'd make beautiful, beautiful things out of those twisty limbs. I'm going to go back and get some of those limbs. I'm going to get me some fence post out of that Bodock. It's kind of nice to be able to go to the woods and get what you need. Kind of a fun thing to think about. Hey, we got a lot of questions this morning. Somebody asked me about planting. They planted their daffodils in October. They mulched them. It was, where was that? That was down around, let's see here. Let me get that. There we go. Got to get out of the Mo Brooks stuff. And if you're popping up, so in Gulf Shores. Now, everything's going to be fine if you got the right daffodils. And I'll have to say, it's all going to be about the right daffodils. The mulch is fine. The mulch really is fine. Don't rake it back. No need to rake it back. It's fine where it is. Leave it in place. Those daffodils don't need to be any warmer than they are. Mulches actually help cool the soil, right? But no, they'll come through that mulch just fine. They'll need the mulch when the spring gets here as they're developing. So and you'll keep the weeds down. So no, everything is fine. You just got to have the right daffodils, and that's pretty important. That's really important in Gulf Shores. And if you want to know what those are, you better give me a call. Let's talk about it. A lot of daffodils won't get enough cold temperatures in Gulf Shores. Just a reminder, if you're new to Gulf Shores, if you're coming from up north in the state, a lot of bulbs will not get enough cold temperatures to bloom in Gulf Shores. So feel free to call me. Let me know what those bulbs are, and we'll see how they do. One thing to remember is if you've gotten bulbs that don't bloom, they are going to be a pain in the neck, because it is so hard to figure out, to figure that out, and they're just going to keep getting weedy. They'll keep growing there, weedy and spreading, but they'll never bloom. So the first year you put them in the ground, if they don't bloom, you need to get rid of them right then, because they ain't going to bloom again in the future. I guarantee if they don't bloom the first year, they are not going to bloom in the future. So let's talk about that. You give me a call, and we'll talk about what your varieties are. That's really important. So the big thing with daffodils, the most important thing, the thing that you got to consider first and foremost before you worry about anything else, is did I get the right variety of daffodil? This is really important in South Alabama. Michael Neal's asking me, what spring flower could be started now? Yeah, it's getting late, so you want something fast. Here's the thing, nasturtiums. I love nasturtiums. Get your marigolds planted. It's almost too late for marigolds. It takes them a little longer, but marigolds are great now. You know, our hot weather's coming on soon. When does spring start, Michael? February 15th, along the Gulf Coast. A little later, farther up. But I'd say getting your marigolds started right now may not seem like a spring flower, but spring is, it's getting late to start spring flowers, given that spring is already here. And marigolds are going to do great during spring. They won't do so well during summer. But I would say, is that enough? Think about those two, nasturtiums and marigolds. I love them both. Nasturtiums, it'd be kind of nice if you started them sooner. But they'll do okay now. They'll definitely do okay. And I love nasturtiums. You can eat them. You can look at them. You can do whatever you want to with them. They are beautiful, wonderful things. Marigolds, you know, I've gotten to where I start eating marigolds. Have I told you all about eating marigolds? Now, let me tell you, it's one kind of marigold. It's the tangerine signet marigold. We use it all the time in cooking. It's absolutely delicious. It's a wonderful marigold. Now that winter's on, I kind of miss it, but I'm going to start me some more of that signet marigold. It's really good. It does okay during the heat. It doesn't like the humidity. Marigolds don't really appreciate the humidity, so you might have to restart it again. You know, there's another thing that I think you could try that should do pretty well. And let me just, while I'm sitting here thinking at it and looking through my seeds, I'll also mention that it's not too late to start Cleome. And I would go ahead and get the Cleome seeds. Do you know what Cleomes are? They're really cool. They like fluctuating temperatures, and they bloom, and they only really germinate when the temperatures are fluctuating. They like hot days, but they like cool nights. They don't tolerate frost. But sometime towards the end of February, it's kind of a good thing to put those Cleomes out. You could start Cleomes in pots if you wanted to, but generally I start them outside. Cleomes, they do well. Another good spring thing. You know, if I said this in Michigan, they'd say, well, wait a minute. No, they're thinking about other things. But our spring is already right. We're sitting right on top of us on the Gulf Coast, so we gotta think about it a little differently. These are plants that most people think of as summer plants, but for us, they're really spring plants. They're spring plants. If you can buy petunias, this is a great time of year to put out petunias. Petunias will take these frost just fine. I'd go ahead and put them out. Old-fashioned petunias are even better. So, you know, a lot of people think of those as summer plants. They're not really summer plants for us. They don't do that well during summer, but boy, do they do well during these cooler temperatures. Michael, did that help? Hope it did. Hope it did. Bruce, oh, this is so good. David Hubble, listen to this. So Bruce sends me this message. David Hubble's going to chuckle. He got a picture of kale, collards, kale, and broccoli stems. And he says, Bruce says, have you ever tried replacing celery in the Trinity? And he says, you know, collard, kale, and broccoli, same size, shape, texture, and color. Worked good in red beans and rice. David, you see what I'm saying? This is the way we used to live. This is the way we used to think. And if those of you who haven't heard me, I think the Holy Trinity is a food is just a pile of bunk. It's basically about people living in grocery stores and using what they had in grocery stores. And yes, Paul Prudhomme lived out of a grocery store. I can tell you that his grandmother did not use, if she lived in the country, as Paul suggested she did. She didn't use celery. They didn't grow celery. They didn't have celery. That's ridiculous. They didn't have bell peppers most of the year. You see what I'm saying? Garlic is its own tricky thing, and onions are tricky too, because they're not always available during the year. So the Holy Trinity, as if it's some kind of backbone of Cajun cooking, that's all made up. You got it right, Bruce. That's the way to do it. You use what's in the garden. And boy, those stems are great. They're delicious. They're going to make great red beans and rice. Better than any celery you could ever try.
Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
All right. Welcome back. Oh, the barn people are coming out of the woodwork. I thought so. You know, people, Rusty says he remembers camping out in the barn. So do I. I remember also camping out in the barn and falling three stories. This is why I'm, you want to know why I'm as bad as I am. That's because. I love camping out in barns. It's a great thing. We used to do it when we were kids too. It's just a great thing, to do that. Rusty remembers it. Who's this? Somebody remembers talking about, Bodoc for fence posts. Let's have a little lesson in trees here for a second. If you don't mind, it's kind of fun to talk about Bodoc. Osage orange. A lot of people think that Bodoc is not native to Alabama. I suspect it is. I also suspect that it was probably native in the Black Belt. May have been native in parts of the Tennessee Valley, but probably less so. I have a feeling it was native to the Black Belt. It's one of these old trees that we tend to forget about. It has a very twisted branching, but boy, the wood lasts forever. It was used, it was commonly used by the Osage Indians and by perhaps by other tribes as bow wood, and for uses that required flexible wood that was very strong. But it also turns out to be very rot resistant, incredibly rot resistant. It would outlast a cedar post. And so it was preferred over cedar, and cedar lasts a long time in the ground. Pervert over black locust. Osage orange. What a really cool thing. It has these fruits that are really interesting. Anybody remember the fruits? I'm going to see if you remember these fruits. The fruits look like giant apples, except you got to look at the fact that the outside of them kind of looks like a picture of a brain. You ever seen a picture of a brain with all those little weird little cells in it? Yeah, that's Osage orange. If that sounds gross to you, well, it's not. It's cool. Osage orange, green fruits. They're green. They got this kind of, how do I describe that? Knobby texture to the top of it. Kind of like the surface of a brain. There's just no other way to describe it. It's really interesting looking. And they're perfectly round. We had all kind of legends about Osage orange fruits. We said that Osage orange, that this was the legend growing up. And this is purely observational from 12-year-olds. We always said that yellow jackets came from Osage orange fruits. And why was that? Because when the fruits broke open, the yellow jackets were always in the fruit looking for sugars and other things. And so we assumed that's where they all grew and developed, that they developed from, you know, in our heads, yellow jackets developed from Osage orange seeds. Well, it's interesting. Osage orange has nothing to do with yellow jackets other than yellow jackets will eat the fruit. But we often took Osage orange fruits. Does anybody remember doing this? And we had Osage orange fruit wars, which could be dangerous. If you've ever been hit by one, you'd know what I'm saying. Osage orange, really cool thing. Really, really neat thing. It's also called bodock, which is our Mississippi and Alabama corruption of the word bodark. Bodark, I think, would be maybe the original French, something like that, which means basically bow wood. Bodock, great, great tree. Glad you remember it. Yeah, those big horse apples make great projectiles. That's right, that's right. That's right. Isn't the densest wood in North America? I don't know. That's a good question. It probably is very dense. You know, I knew it was Osage orange because as soon as I laid the chainsaw into it, the chainsaw slowed way down. I didn't even have to see that yellow. It was an old tree. It was on the ground. It was just the wood was almost, the outer wood was almost black. But it slowed, and I knew, oh, it's bodock. And then you saw the inner wood. It's really cool looking, beautiful stuff. So David says, so we're back to this. And you know, David and I argue about it a little bit, but not too much. And I think David's, we both kind of come around to the realization that a lot of what we read about cooking in the South is basically grocery store cooking. It's basically recipes that derived from the fact that the company store started selling his stuff and we didn't get stuff out of the garden. And so our recipes look more and more like recipes from other parts of the country. With the exception that, maybe we put more fat in it. But that's not really Southern cooking. And so, as David points out, there weren't all the fancy spice blends, David says. That's true. And that Cajuns were cooking for 200 years before Tony, how do you say his last name, Tony Shacher seasoning was available. And so we've got all these things that make Cajun cooking, which are really about what you buy at the grocery store, but that's not Cajun cooking at all, nor it's not Southern cooking at all. Cooking with lots of sugar is not even particularly necessarily Southern cooking, and sweetened, pre-sweetened tea isn't necessarily Southern cooking. My grandmother didn't grow up with that. My great-grandmother didn't at all. She thought it was the weirdest thing in the world to pre-sweeten your tea. She didn't like it that way. She was, don't tell her she wasn't Southern. She'd slap you down. No, she wouldn't. She's too nice about that. But her, you know, her brothers might have. So it's interesting, thinking about Southern cooking and thinking about, well, what would the garden have made? How would the garden have made that cooking different? So there it is, Bruce. We all agree with you 100%. You want really good red beans and rice? Throw away the recipes. Use what's in the garden. That's it. It's great. I change my bean recipe every time I go to the garden because I got a different thing. You know, one week it might be, I got a whole bunch of extra peppers. I always got a bunch of extra peppers. I try to. So I throw them in there. I cook them down, make kind of a red pepper sauce, make that with the red beans and rice. If you think that ain't great. Yeah, I still get onions from the store. And they're okay. They're fine. They add to the presence of things. I try to grow my own garlic because it makes a difference. I can taste it. I can taste it. But, you know, there's a lot of other things I'm trying as well. It's not bad to use onions out of the yard. I've done it before. Makes really great beans. If you know what a wild onion is, if you can smell it and it smells like a wild onion, well, you know what? If it smells like a wild onion, don't worry about looks. If it smells like a wild onion, you know what it is? It's a wild onion. And it's great to cook with. Really good. A little farther north. And, you know, you can use ramps. The other thing is I'm really beginning to appreciate that thinking about things I'm putting in stews and beans. Leeks are really great. And those things we call elephant garlic, which are really leeks, they can be really good in stews and soups. Really great. Lots of different things. Lots of different things you can use in beans and soups and stews. And if you want to be authentic Cajun, you think that Holy Trinity, that ain't Cajun. That ain't Cajun. There are very few times in the year where you would have that set of ingredients, and the only way in New Orleans that you would have those ingredients is to buy them from the grocery store. You weren't growing them yourself, and they wouldn't be available at the same time. Nobody's growing celery. That's hard. Celery's hard. It really is like the one crop that is completely alien to southern growing conditions. I can help you grow a lot of things. Now, I did get in trouble for saying this about celery before, and I have to say this real quickly. Just excuse me, forgive me for going on about celery, but I said celery's pretty alien, and somebody got really mad because they had figured out how to grow celery, and they said, "You're completely wrong." They were growing celery. They'd been doing it every year, and it was really a kind of a badge of pride, and I can see why, because boy, was it hard. And you really have to go to a lot of trouble to get celery, and you're still only going to get it for a narrow window, and it still probably isn't going to be any better than the celery you get in the grocery store. So, you know, but don't get the celery at the grocery store, but don't tell me it's traditional. Don't tell me it's Cajun cooking. Sorry, Paul. Sorry, had to go on about that. But that was what you started, Bruce. Hope you like that. Yeah, so Jim over in got a place up in Greene County and sent me a picture of, you know, Jim, there's all these various kinds of hooks and snatch hooks, and I have a hard time figuring out what exactly each one was used for. That is a funny looking snatch hook, isn't it? It doesn't look, it's not symmetrical. It's kind of weird. I don't know. I always wonder what these different snatch hooks were used for. I'd say that was probably used for a log. A lot of times what you'll find in a barn are some hooks that were used for hay. And I don't know if you've ever seen those, but there were things called hay trolleys in barns, since we're talking about barns. Anybody know what a hay trolley is? They are super cool. And you find a barn with a hay trolley, and you got an old, old barn. Anybody know what a hay trolley is? Give me a call. We'll talk about it. It's a really cool-looking thing. But sometimes they use those hooks for hay trolleys. And now, since we're talking about Bodoc hedge apples, as they were called, which is fine, because they often grew in hedges, and people actually use Bodoc, Osage Orange, to make hedges. It was famous in the Black Belt that a lot of plantations, you knew the edges of those plantations because they had big groves of Bodoc in them, because they could be just about impenetrable. Well, David, what do you think about this music, huh? Another kind of traditional, Italian traditional, which is very traditional in New Orleans, right? We're going to be back. Give us a call, 251-343-0106.
Baccia mi, ma guguzza, guguzza bella.
She's my pizza pie with lots of mozzarella.
With guguzza, I wanna be.
Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
Yeah, welcome back. Gulf Coast Sunday morning with Plain Gardening. We got lots of fun questions going on this morning. They're lots of fun. So David says, I wonder how the folks in folks around New Orleans, folks in Louisiana did with drying out things like, could they dry out things like peppers or onions or celery to use in the Trinity out of season? Well, there's this thing, David, we have. It's called humidity. I don't know if you've ever tried to dry out stuff, but it ain't easy. You almost have to have a dehydrator. It's possible. I don't think, you know, drying vegetables and drying other things are not something that a lot of people do along the Gulf Coast because the humidity is so high. It's done sometimes in northern areas, and particularly as the temperatures get cooler, because the humidity will actually, well, the dew point's lower, let me say that. And it's a little easier to dry things in a way, but it can be difficult. It can be difficult to dry stuff in our climate without contraptions and mostly without electricity. Just something to think about. I think that here's what drove Gulf Coast cooking and why it was different. And it was because you could use things all year long, right? Fresh. And I think we've forgotten that, but it wasn't the same thing all year long. Right? There it is. I struggle with preserving peppers because I want to have them even when they're not producing. But you can almost grow them all year long. If you have a container, you could. But I don't know. Bell peppers, nah, you can't grow them all year long. You can't even grow them through July and August. I mean, you know, you get basically 2 months of bell peppers. What a crazy thought that bell peppers were traditional part of 19th century or early 20th century cuisine on the Gulf Coast. Bell peppers? Are you kidding me? it's just weird. I got to think about it. I mean, you know, it's just weird. Jim, and as I knew he would, because it does bring up memories for people who grew up with barns. And maybe you're just driving by on the road and you know, God, that is a beautiful barn. Do you ever do that? I do it a lot. I just drive by that. I think, boy, that is a beautiful barn. I do that. Barns even move me more than beautiful houses do. And there ain't many of the beautiful houses left. There's a lot of monstrosities out there, but they're not, you know, beautiful houses. And that doesn't mean with a bunch of Greek columns. Just houses that have good proportions. Houses that are simple and straightforward, beautiful things. I love houses, but you see a barn and you say, man, what a thing. Because it was built for a purpose. And you can almost read the purpose in the barn, at least in the old barns. I guess you can in the new barns. The new barns are about tractor grease and big barrels full of oil and concrete floors and, you know, whatever. But old barns, you can see another purpose in them, and they're kind of cool and they're beautiful. So Jim from Georgetown, he sends me this picture of this of the barn that he grew up with. Looks like a dairy operation, was it, Jim? I think it probably started out that way. And it's just because it's, you know, it really motivates you growing up with barns like that. It's something you really come to appreciate. Jim, I can not only see the barn, I can also see what would now be a very, very, you'd have a fortune in that 1969 Ford truck, if I see that correctly, parked in front of the barn. Boy, they are just, they're the things to have nowadays. But yeah, beautiful, beautiful setup. The beautiful barns we grew up with. Beautiful barns we grew up with an apple and a peach orchard. Yep, beautiful place, beautiful barns. If you know, one of the things we that perplexes us nowadays is we've got these barns and they were built for things that we no longer do, and that we've forgotten about. And so we struggle to use the barns. We struggle to find a use for the barns, and so they collapse as a result. And we sort of forget that they really are guides to another way of living. That's what barns are for me. They're guides to another way of living, to another way of thinking about how you adapt to the world around you. And that's what hay trolleys were about. Oh, man, nobody's calling me about hay trolleys. But hay trolleys were these things that used to be in the tops of the barns, and you'll see them occasionally. They're racks. They're metal racks. I suspect they had other ways of doing it before they had the metal. But a lot of times, your hay was loose. You took your hay. You weren't shipping your hay to, you know, some other place far away. You were using it to feed your own cows and your own horses. So there wasn't much need of baling it. Kind of was redundant to bale it. You just took it, you loaded it on the wagon out of the field, made it a lot simpler. Didn't need fancy equipment. Just loaded it on the, you know, there were lots of ways of doing it. You'd easily do it with horses. If you wanted to pull behind, or you could just rake it and throw it on the wagon, and you took the wagon to the barn and threw the hay in the barn loose. And it stored really well that way, but you needed it's kind of nice to have a hook that came out of the roof that allowed you to grab hay and move it out of the barn when you needed it, because it might be sitting way back in the barn. Really nice to have. And that hay trolley was good even in the days of square bales. They were using it with square bales, but they had a different kind of hook. That's what a hay trolley was. Really cool. You'll see them in barns. 72 GMC, sorry. That'd be a pretty valuable thing, too. Got the era right, if not quite the era right, if not quite the brand. It's kind of a far piece away. Yeah, yeah. I know you do. I know you wish you had it now. But, yeah, so, David, no, I think you're completely agreeing with me, and I think we're sort of making the point, aren't we? So David Hubble is completely agreeing with me about the variety of ingredients that were used in Cajun foods depending on the seasons. And David brought up the point, well, maybe it could have been dehydrated. Maybe you could make that argument, but, nah, not on the Gulf Coast. They had a little technique up, and I've seen it in the mountains, what do they call them? Bean britches or something. But what you'd do is you'd take your beans and you'd literally sew them onto a string. Sew the beans onto a string and let them dry in the barn. You had to have a barn, and you had to have a barn that had good airflow, kind of like a tobacco barn. And they'd dry out. But it's hard to do on the Gulf Coast. Hey, we're going to be back. Give us a call. We got to have a break here.
About 1825, I left Tennessee very much alive. And I never would have got through the Arkansas mud if I hadn't been a-riding that Tennessee stud.
It's Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast with Mobile's award-winning garden expert and chief horticultural advisor for Mobile Botanical Gardens, Bill Finch. We'll talk about living and growing on the Gulf Coast. Now, your personal yard and garden consultant, here's Bill Finch.
Oh boy, the questions are coming on. You know why? I'll tell you why. Because folks are realizing spring is coming on. When does spring start on the Gulf Coast? It starts somewhere around February 15th, February 20th. I'm sorry, that's life. That's the way it is. It's true. Most places in the world, spring isn't coincident with what we might call solar spring. And on the Gulf Coast, it is. We spring comes early. We don't have Austrian seasons. We don't have German seasons. I know everybody thinks we do. Everybody wants you to think that we all live in Germany, I guess. Well, Germany's a fine place. But you don't live there. You live in Alabama. It's got a different set of seasons, and spring is coming on pretty soon. You got to get ready for it. It's coming up. You know, the bulbs are coming up. I'm already hearing about it. They're coming up. Let them come on. Not a thing you can do about it at this point. Mulch them. Mulch them will be fine. Let the bulbs come on. Don't even need to fertilize them now. You might could fertilize them a little later, but whether they need fertilizer or not is a kind of an open question. Spring is coming on about February 15th, February 20th on the Gulf Coast. As you move north of Mobile to Citronelle, it's progressively later. By the time you get to Montgomery, I would say spring starts. So when do I want spring to start around Montgomery? I'd say about March 1st. About March 1st. Yeah, sure. Maybe a little later, maybe a few days later, but about March 1st. You know, I kind of take the last average frost for an area and then back it up 2 weeks. How's that? That seems like a good way to start spring. And so by the time you get up to, say, Huntsville, where the last average frost is, what, I'm going to say about April 6th, well, I'd back spring up and say that spring starts about March 20th. That's the difference, huh? That's the difference in the places where we live and when spring can actually start. Though there are many types of spring, and it's good to know. You know, I've seen the wildflowers. The wildflowers see spring occurring in multiple stages. And there are a lot of wildflowers all throughout the state, from North Alabama all the way down to the Gulf Coast. A lot of those, particularly the ephemeral wildflowers, the ones that come up before the trees leaf out, they're already up. They're already absorbing sunlight. Many of them are already in bloom. Even Cardamine, some of the Cardamines are up. It's in blooming in North Alabama. It's interesting. Many springs, many types of springs. You know, there's the red maple spring. We're already undergoing that along the Gulf Coast. It's beginning to develop even farther north. Red maple spring, and then when they're in flower and beginning to fruit, and then you've got the red bud spring, and then you've got if you live in an area where they grow, then you've got the dogwood spring later. And then even later than that, you've got things like, the spring where the Philadelphus starts blooming. That's very late spring, almost American summer, is American summer in most parts of the... So different types of spring, but it's about to happen. So you want to get ready for it. Springs heat up pretty quickly here. So now the question is pruning, and I'll tell you, is it time to prune back the fig bush? It's fine to do that probably now. You don't want to encourage a lot of rapid growth now, but I think you're probably okay. I kind of wait a little bit later to start pruning back. There's no downside, even when it's leafing out. There's really no downside to pruning back a fig. As long as you do it by, on the Gulf Coast, get it done before, certainly before about the third week of March, but any time between now and then would be fine. You should be fine. I don't think you'll encourage unnecessary growth. And if you have any questions about how to prune that fig tree back, you give me a call. We'll go through it step by step. Step by step in terms of what we really want to do. Is it time to plant citrus? And I'm going to say no. Wait just a little while. We still don't know. There could be a big, big, terrible blast coming out of the Arctic. It's a weird year. It's a year with weirdly fluctuating temperatures. I am not confident to say that we have seen even the worst of winter yet. And by that I mean to say we could see a day or two of very cold temperatures, which could be very problematic for citrus. So do I think it's time to plant citrus? No. Let me say no. I just don't see any reason to do it now. Keep that citrus in the garage. Give it some sunlight as it needs it, but you better be ready to take it into the garage. When is citrus going to be ready to plant on the Gulf Coast? I'd say wait until that second week in March. The third week in March, you'll be fine. It ain't going to grow much anyway because the ground's going to still be cold. Second, third week in March, fourth week in March, that's the citrus. Now, if you've got apples and pears and peaches, you know, I don't want to make life hard for you. I don't want to make it difficult, but, you know, plants are as different as people are different, and you got to treat them all a little differently sometimes. And the truth is, apples, pears, and peaches, and those kinds of crops, blueberries, they're not like tropical plants like citrus, more subtropical plants. They're not, they can be planted out right now, and you should. You shouldn't wait on them. With citrus, I'd definitely wait on. Is that good? Does Satsumas ever need lining? Liming? Well, yeah, probably. At some point, they certainly could use lime. They are more tolerant of extremes, I will say, than a lot of than some citrus. They will tolerate both high alkalinity or moderately high alkalinity and near neutral conditions and slightly more than neutral conditions, slightly more alkaline than neutral. But they really like about 6, pH of about 6. They're going to be just fine with that, which is moderately acid. Some of our soils are around 4.5 to 5.5, and that's pretty acid. In those conditions, if you've got pretty acid soil, it probably will not hurt. It will not hurt by any means to add some lime to it. And I would just say, yes, it won't hurt to add lime, and partly because that lime, if it's dolomitic lime, it's going to have a good balance of calcium and magnesium, and citrus need both of those. And so it's good to go ahead and add that. But I'm also going to say, if you've got plenty of organic matter around that citrus and you have good, deep organic soil, you probably won't even have to worry about the lime. Won't hurt. It won't hurt. But make sure you have plenty of good, build up that organic matter during the summer. That's when it counts the most, not during winter. You want to rake the organic matter back. You want to rake the mulch back during winter to let the plant warm up. But you just rake it back on there in summer and leave it on during summer. Let it all rot down. Just bring in lots of organic matter. It'll help. And a little bit of lime can help too. A little bit of lime can help too. I don't think they're as particular about it as some trees. I don't think so. Throwing cottonseed meal around the fruit trees today. Is that okay? Yes, sir. It won't hurt at all. And here's why cottonseed meal is unlike other types of fertilizer. I hate looking at that. I hate looking at this, Keith. I hate looking at that thing being towed behind a trailer. But yeah, cottonseed meal doesn't hurt at all. And here's, I'll tell you why when we come back.
Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
Samson seems sort of sweaty. The jasmine is touched their word.
Yeah, look at that. Look at that. So, really cool pictures people are sending me. Really cool pictures. So we got acorns growing in an old, is a red oak, right? Old red oak tree. The acorns sprouted in the tree, probably brought there by, a pack rat, a chipmunk, a mouse, whatever. And they sprouted in the tree and left quite a tangle and quite a mess in a pocket of the tree that then maybe perhaps later healed up, or that, sometimes those rotten places will run up and a good bit up and down the tree. Keith, I was going to answer your question, and then I have to look at this, Keith, what I got to look at, it's this thing being towed on a trailer, and it just, like, I got to put my hand over it in order to answer your question. So I'm looking at Zip Whip, and I'm looking at the image Keith sent me. Ooh. But here it is. Can you throw cottonseed meal on trees? Let's get right to it. And then I'm gonna close the door on that image. So yeah, you can indeed put cottonseed meal on right now. Cottonseed meal is what we call a fertilizer. It's a natural fertilizer. It's got a good bit of nitrogen in it. Not as much as a chemical fertilizer might have, but that's okay. You don't need that much nitrogen. The good thing about cottonseed meal, there are two really good things about it. One, it's released slowly. It isn't released all at once. It isn't an explosion. And plants don't need that kind of lubrication, which is kind of how I describe fertilizers. It kind of just greases the wheels, kind of makes them run efficiently so that the plant can produce its own food. They don't need it all at once. They need it over an extended period of time. It would be like, filling your car up with oil and then having all the oil released in 5 minutes, which doesn't make any sense. It's supposed to be there for the engine over the long haul. That's what cottonseed meal does. It's a slow-release fertilizer, and that makes it much more efficient. So it's really good. You don't need as much nitrogen because it's being released more efficiently. Another really good thing about cottonseed meal is that it is released depending in large measure on the temperature. And that's because, I'm sneezing. And that's because bacteria break it down into a form that plants can use. So you know what? You can put it on during winter and the plants aren't going to use it during winter. I wouldn't put it on during fall because it might get warm enough that it is released during fall, but you can put it on any time during winter and it's not going to be released until March, late March. And that's fine. And in fact, it might actually be beneficial to put it on in late winter so that it's sitting there and ready to go as the plant needs it in early spring. So there it is. Good. What else did I get? We got the fig thing. You know, David brings up a really interesting point, as he often does. David Hubbell, we had a great time talking today, in case y'all missed it, about the Holy Trinity and how the Holy Trinity is bunk. Now, please believe me, we ain't talking religion here. We're talking a different kind of religion. No, we're not talking about football either. We're talking about Paul Prudhomme and this thing he called the Holy Trinity and what you had to cook out of New Orleans. And it's just total bunk. Because traditional Creole and Cajun cooking could not have been based on celery, was not based on bell peppers, I can assure you. Probably wasn't even based on having onions every dish, because onions would have been precious at times. You used what you had. And that's traditional Cajun cooking. And it's the joy of Cajun cooking is using what you have, not what the grocery store makes available to you, but what comes out of the garden. That's great Cajun cooking. Celery is not a southern crop. Never has been. Never really, unlikely it ever will be, quite honestly, because of its growing conditions. I mean, you can do it, but it's hard. Really hard. So, what did they use and how did they use it and could it have been dried? This is all the things we talked about, and it's always worth thinking about. And that's why gardens are so beautiful, because whatever you got in the garden, you use it, and it just makes things better. And it makes it different every time. So you want to make a good thing of red beans and rice? Well, you use what you got in the garden. If you got mustard stems, you use mustard stems. If you got a few peppers, you throw them in. If you don't, you don't worry about it. If you got some tomatoes, you throw them in. Not until the end. You don't put tomatoes. David, is this right? You do not put tomatoes in until the beans are nearly through cooking. There's a lot of reasons for that. Otherwise, you could have some problems. You don't want those acid things in too early on in the cooking process. But there's a lot of great things you can use, and there is no Holy Trinity. That's important. Now, then we got to talking about dried foods, which I think is very, very interesting too. And whether or not you could use dried food to you could use drying to preserve vegetables to have them throughout the year. And then we decided, well, on the Gulf Coast, it's really hard to dry things unless you got electricity. And even then, it's hard to dry things. So maybe not. But one of the things that people used to do, and David was mentioning with tobacco, is they fermented things, which actually works quite well. And in many parts of the world with climates similar to ours, fermentation is a big way of preserving food. So just interesting. Is Gary, did Gary have the patience to hold on? Is he still there, Phil? Ah, Dalton, thank you. So, Gary, give me a call back. I'd love to talk with you about the orange trees. Sorry we missed connections. That's my fault. A little earlier. But give us a call back if you get a chance. What else have we got? What else have we got to think about here? Ooh, I love this picture from Clay. Two great pictures. First off, I got an incredible picture of a barn from Clay, from Bibb County, and up in Piper. What an incredible barn! And it's interesting to read the history of uses in that barn. At some point, you could see that the old uses were forgotten even when they constructed new parts on the barn. That shed that comes out and prevents you from putting anything into the top part of the barn is kind of odd, but things were changing. People had different uses for the barn. They were trying to make sense of an old barn. And now I see that somebody's gone in and framed in the old windows. Isn't that interesting? So it was kind of a barn and house all together, wasn't it? I wonder what the history there. That is really an interesting barn. And it must have been used for a lot of different things. Really beautiful barn, though. Incredibly complex barn, but beautiful. There's a widow's peak at one end. Do you know what the widow's peak is? You see the widow's peak? It's really interesting. We can talk about what that does. And then Clay sent me another picture of an old-fashioned haying where you just used very simple. You when you use loose hay, it's great. Works fine. Works great. If you're using the hay on your own farm and around your own barn, you didn't need to. You didn't need these fancy balers and all that kind of stuff. You just used it loose. It's great. It works fine. And they had contraptions that were mechanical contraptions. Didn't take a lot of energy, but they're really cool if you've ever seen them working. Just they rake up the hay and rake it up onto the wagon. Beautiful things. You could pull it with a horse. And, yeah, you could even use a square baler if you wanted to. But you had to bring the loose hay in first is what you can see what they did. Alicia got a beautiful picture of her garlic and romaine lettuce doing just fine, just fine. You know that the one of the cool things about garlic, and you kind of have to you play it by ear, is you can use those leaves this time of year. Just use the leaves in your cooking. Use them in salad. It's a beautiful, beautiful thing in a salad to have those garlic leaves. They're kind of hot and spicy, but really good. Just cut them up and put them in a salad. Don't over-harvest the green leaves, but you got plenty of them there. I think you can harvest a few of them along with that romaine lettuce. It'll be really beautiful. Alicia already has her spring garden. It's already going. It looks nice. It's doing really, really well. Yeah, I got to answer this question about the 15-year-old fig tree that produces never produces every year, but then hard as a golf ball. Yeah, I need to know a little bit more about that. Cliff, can you call me?
There is no sickness, toil, or danger in that fair land to which I go.
Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
All right, quick survey of things. We've got a lot of texts this morning, and folks, you can text me. It's always nicer to hear your voice, and a lot of things we can't deal with by text because it's too complicated, like the fig question from Cliff. Cliff, I'm gonna give it a stab because maybe you'll call me and it'll be easier. But it's good to hear from you by text too, and I've got a lot. I got some great pictures from text. From Keith, I got these two. There's the stink bug picture up top, and then there's the stink bug picture below it, Keith. Oh, boy, are they both distracting. But I got a lot of other pleasant pictures, too, I'll have to say. And one of them is a picture of an eagle down by the waterfront. It's kind of neat to see these eagles come back, man. They're coming back in a big way. I hear there are some problems associated with various human created issues. Yeah, I know it was for Sean, but I have to look at it too. You know, this picture Keith sent. Oh, it's just a crazy picture. Any rate, so great picture of the eagle. Really a beautiful thing. And what else have I got? Great pictures of satsumas from Jim. This thing, Wisdom from Kentucky. Wisdom from Kentucky Bill, I should say. And that is that hedge apples, what we call Osage orange, or Bodock, or Bodark, or Mock orange. You know, it's crazy how these names get moved around. And people in different parts of the country have different names. Bodock, Bodark, down here in the French world. French-speaking part of the world is what we is the name that stuck in Mississippi and Alabama and Louisiana and up to Missouri. The idea that these hedge apples, the Bodark, prevented spiders, I have never heard that. You know, it is the science of 12-year-olds. Right? Figuring out, well, Bodock's, Bodock is, this must be where, Must be where yellow jackets come from. Well, no, not quite. Do they prevent spiders? Now, this is interesting. I have no idea. I can't explain how that legend grew and developed, but it's an interesting one. Just an interesting observation. Rodney, I'm listening. You tell me what's going on.
Hey, good morning, Bill. You and I could talk about barns all day. I grew up in my first year of life was in a barn. Literally. That's no joke. But at any rate, my brother has dug up some scuppernongs out of the woods. He planted them in his yard and created a trellis. And let's see, last year he got 10 gallons of scuppernongs off of them. But one of them didn't bloom at all, it might have bloomed, but it didn't create any fruit. And I told him it may have been a male, and I don't know if the wild scuppernongs need a female and a male.
Well, there you go. So when we start talking about sex with plants, it scares everybody because they do things in awfully odd ways, at least from a human perspective. But yes, indeed, there are some plants that actually have separate male and female, just like people do, sort of. And what's interesting is that in the wild, most muscadines and scuppernongs are basically in the southern language, the word scuppernong and muscadine both basically mean the same thing. Muscadines have both male and female, and about half of the vines growing in the woods, at least half, are male. And they'll never produce fruit. But they are important pollinators. So you need one male for a bunch of females. So it's probably good that he has one vine that is a male, even though it's wasting his fence row space or his trellis space.
Not any longer. He cut it down the other day, and I told him you might have made a mistake.
Well, it depends on how far he is from other male vines. So
yeah,
if he's got
others in the woods there.
Yeah, if he's near the woods, then the pollen will get carried pretty well from one to another. But yeah, that's it. So, and you know, I have had some of the wild muscadines are as fine as anything you could ever buy from a store. What's interesting is that as we cultivate plants, as we bring them into cultivation, we tend to mess with We tend to mess with their sexual identity a lot. And so tomatoes, for example, never cross-pollinate. They never have true sex. Rarely do they ever have true sex. Most of the cultivars of tomatoes, they don't need pollination. They pollinate themselves. They don't really have sex anymore. Muscadines, we have developed self-fruitful muscadines, and that's, probably I haven't really studied it. Some of it may be parthenogenesis. It may be they don't need pollination. Some of it may be that male flowers are produced on the same plants with female flowers. But when you buy a cultivated muscadine, most of them do not need a male. But wild, they still have sex in the old-fashioned way.
Okay, one last real quick. Fertilization of those muscadines. What would I do?
You know, if they're growing great, you don't need a lot of fertilizer. I would be very cautious because muscadines can grow like crazy, and to get them to produce, you do need to trim them up a little bit. And you're going to get a ton of vegetative.
He called me the other day when he was doing his trimming.
Yeah, yes, which is a long story. Let's go to the fertilizer. You don't want him to grow too much. And muscadines don't need a lot of fertilizer. I would use cottonseed meal because it keeps you from overgrowing them. It's a moderate. It will provide a moderate dose of fertilizer. And you shouldn't have as many problems using cottonseed meal. And don't even if they're producing a ton of green growth, well, you don't want them to produce a whole lot more green growth than what they're producing now. So you may not need to add a lot of fertilizer on a wild muscadine because they're pretty good, as you noticed in the woods. They do pretty well without fertilizer.
Right.
But use cottonseed meal if you're going to use a fertilizer. And then, of course, pruning is an involved process. Is he pretty good with that? Does he know how to do it?
Well, he's learning. He's had these vines probably 4, maybe 5 years. And he and I have talked back and forth about it and what have you. And I'm not the most intelligent person when it comes to that, but at least I do know a little bit, and he's gotten better at it.
Yeah. And you know, there are people who do it all the time who are really fast at it. I'll admit, I'm slow. I got to think about it. But you're basically trying to reduce the amount of foliage that is carried over from year to year and vine growth, and you can really cut back a muscadine a lot every year. It's shocking to people how much muscadine you need to cut back in order to get good production, but that's the key. And you're cutting it back to a few spurs, which we can talk about what a spur is,
right?
And
So the muscadine actually probably produces best off of new growth.
Yes, it does. But it is on a second year spur, which is complicated. Yeah, so it's that's right. But it's the new growth that's producing on a second year spur. So it's but that's kind of the way you think about it.
Well, I'm equipped with a little knowledge. I'll give my brother a call and we'll talk about it. And I appreciate it, Bill.
Yeah, all right. Good to hear from you, Rodney. Beautiful pictures of barns. You know, this is the good thing about starting a conversation about barns is I get to look at these beautiful pictures of barns. There's a beautiful barn from Anderson County, Kentucky. Sad to know that it's gone, but I get to look at these beautiful pictures. I'm going to talk about barns more often just so I can look at these beautiful pictures of barns that people send me. Really, really nice to see. Jim has sent me a great picture of a pineapple that he has grown. It's beautiful. You can grow these beautiful, and you know, they're just beautiful to look at, aren't they? They're prettier than grocery store pineapples. What is it that makes a homegrown pineapple prettier than the pineapples you get at the grocery store? It's hard for me to say. They're not as big, but they're beautiful. Beautiful looking things. Yeah, so this is a bug assault. I love this thing. It shoots table salt like a shotgun. That's really cool. Great for stink bugs. I got to see this thing working, Tony. That is the coolest looking thing. Yeah, I'd like to know more about it. We're gonna come back and look at this. But Bill has a question about plant spacing versus row spacing. I'm listening, Bill. Tell me what's going on.
Good morning. I texted you a couple of weeks ago and said to call back about it. And when you read a seed pack and it says, as an example, your plant-to-plant spacing should be 24 inches, but it says, but in rows that are 36 inches apart, whatever. I guess my question is, if you can grow them plant-to-plant 24 inches apart, why does the row have to be 36 inches? Why can't that be 24 inches as well?
Because life is about making room for your booty. Uh-huh. I don't know how else to say it. Here's the thing. Rows are about rows, making room for you to move in and out of your plants.
Mm-hmm.
And so when they do the calculations for how much light a plant needs, they first figure out how much space do I need for the row, and then they figure out how close the plants can be. So if you wanted to do, so let's go back and look at it another way. If you wanted an ideal plant spacing, it would be how many inches is each plant apart from another plant. And in fact, if you're growing in beds, that's what I do. I ignore the spacing that they put on packages because mm-hmm. they're always making sure that they add enough space for a row first. And I just plant them in beds and I plant them a certain number of inches apart. So, Bill, hold on, because we're going to come back and we're going to explore the potential for this in just a minute.
If it keeps on raining, levee's gonna break. And when the levee breaks...
Welcome back to Plain Gardening for the Gulf Coast. Ask Bill Finch your gardening questions now at 343-0106.
All right, Bill, let's think about this for a second. Bill's asking me about plant spacing versus row spacing and why there's recommendations, why the recommendations for spacing between plants difference for the plant spacing between rows. And I tried to explain it, and I could tell it didn't go over very well. So here's I'm going to start again, Bill.
Okay.
So here, this would be ideal. And this was, in fact, if you've never read Sir Thomas Browne, everybody should have to read Sir Thomas Browne because it's beautiful prose. Sir Thomas Browne wrote in the 15th, 16th century. And he wrote about garden, the gardens of Cyrus, and he said everybody should plant on the quincunx, he called it. And a quincunx is basically a diamond. And it's one diamond intersecting with another diamond so that each plant is more or less spaced the same distance apart.
Uh-huh.
And it looks like, if you can imagine a pecan orchard. You remember, have you ever gone through, looked at a pecan orchard, and it's like, oh, they're kind of all planted on a weird diagonal? Well, they're actually mostly planted on a diamond grid. And that's the way you could plant most plants, so that each plant is the same distance apart. But in a garden, you have to take account of, and I'm going to be more polite this time, you have to take account for everybody's big feet. And so if you planted everything on a diamond basis, you wouldn't have any room to move in the garden, and you'd step on all your plants. Mm-hmm. So they basically, when they come up with a little extrapolation on a seed card, they don't think about growing things in beds, which is the way they should. They think about growing things in rows, which is how people used to do it. And they give, and each row has to have room for you to put your big feet in between it. And so that's basically how it works. But when you're thinking about plants, a lot of directions, not on mini seed packs, will just give the spacing between plants. And right. You basically use that spacing all around and up to about 3 feet wide. And after 3 feet, after you've planted an area, a bed about 3 feet wide, you got to have room for your big feet. And there's your row. But yes, okay. If you're growing in rows, you have to account for the spacing between rows, which is why 24 inches mostly. And then once they figure, oh, we've got 24 inches for your big feet, well, then how close do the plants need in order to get enough sunlight? And so they plant the plants a little closer together since they've made that 24 inches. If you're planting on a grid, oh, this is geometry to give you a headache. If you're planting on a grid, though, the plants, you're planting on a diagonal. So it depends on what kind of plant and how big that plant gets. I think when I'm thinking about how big to plant, I think about how big does this plant get? How much space in the garden does it take up? And I kind of have a feel for that now. So if I'm planting garlic, I know that really I don't need to plant the garlic any somewhere between 6 and 10 inches apart, because they don't take up that much room, but they need about 6 to 10 inches, and I plant them on a diamond grid 6 to 10 inches apart so that each plant's about that far apart. Some are a little farther apart than others. That's just the way diamonds work. And there it is.
Yeah, well, I suspect I've been doing okay. I normally allow myself maybe 24 inches of, row for a working row to get a wheelbarrow down or to walk and service one side of a bed, and then run my plants, let's say, in a 4 foot wide bed, and then on the other side of that 4 foot wide bed I'd run another, allowing for 2 feet between plants, running them down again, and then next to that would have another working or walking row. So they seem to be doing okay. But I was wondering.
Yeah, and so most of them expect that you're not planting in beds but in rows. And then they mm-hmm. so they figure out how much light's going to be incident between the rows, and then they figure out the spacing after that. But you're not doing it that way. You know, why do I say 3 foot rather than 4 foot beds? And that also is about two things: the length of your arms and how far your booty sticks out.
Right.
And both of those things are kind of important, and you'll discover that. You can't lean over without having your booty stick out. And
okay.
and that means you can't have your rows have to be a certain width. And I tend to make my rows too narrow, and so I'm frequently bumping into things in back of me. So, but 3 feet's about as good, as long as my arms can reach without and weed easily. That's why I
yes.
picked that number.
Well, do you about, have time well, for a quick question about corn?
Sure.
Okay, I just mowed down my fava beans, my cover crop, and I'm going to plant corn. And did Silver Queen last year, did very, very well. How far apart would you plant corn, far apart per, let's say, per plant, and then the next row over, what's the minimum I could get away with there?
So you're determined to plant the corn in rows, and you don't have to. You can plant it in beds just like you plant everything else. So if I had a three-foot
okay.
if I had a three-foot bed, I would plant three rows of corn in that bed on a diamond
okay.
grid. You see what I'm saying?
Yes.
If I had a four-foot bed, which you do, I might be tempted to go with four rows, but that'd probably be a bit too much.
Okay.
But certainly with a 4 foot bed, three rows would be just about right, you know, and there it is. The old fashioned way is not to think in rows at all, to think in circles. And corn was traditionally planted in circles. We call them
mm-hmm.
hills. And the circle could be of varying diameters, but by planting them in a circle, you could ensure that pollination was a lot better, because.
Okay.
Okay, so it's fun to think about corn, but in beds it'll work just fine. Just get as many rows as close together as you can. But I would say four foot beds, easily you could manage three. You could manage three rows of corn in that with the middle row staggered a little bit. If you see what I'm saying,
mm-hmm.
when you thin the seedlings out, you'll stagger that middle row. So that it's so that it kind of sits on a diagonal between the two rows on the edges.
All right, and how far apart would you plant the seeds?
Closer than they would actually be in life, but you actually want those plants to be, you know, you're going to want the plants to be somewhere around 10 to 12 inches apart in a bed
okay.
like that.
Well, thank you very much.
All right, Bill. Good to hear from you. Hey, listen, I want to, before we run out of time, I want to talk, Phil, Wayne says his grandpa, Phil Barlow, and his uncle, Sidney Boudreau, were wonderful cooks. And he said they used wild onions all the time. And he mentions those species of thistle. David Hubble is going to love to hear this. There's a species of thistle in South Louisiana that grows along ditches and low-lying areas that gets about 3 feet tall, is about 2 inches in diameter, that was used sometimes to substitute for celery. And I've heard about using thistles as substitutes for celery. I am not sure which thistle this is. We're going to have to work on it. But it's always good to hear. Yeah, people, this is traditional cooking, not grocery store cooking, not celery. We'll talk about that when we come back. Next week.
Put it in a big brown bag for me. Seal right around.